Hello to everyone. Welcome to the podcast today. Just a quick programming note. Taking It Down will be off next week, so no official show on Tuesday, August 25th, but we'll be back the week after. That's no worries. That's a planned break. We'll just be off next week. As for today, we've got some pop culture items up for you, including a brief discussion of two HBO shows that are either winding down their season or just wrapped up, which are Perry Mason and I May Destroy You. We'll also discuss some music album stuff as well, which is interesting. Taking It Down is a podcast brought to you by the Alabama Take, and I'm your host and editor-in-chief of that website. Blaine Duncan's my name. If you would like to support our endeavors even more than just listening, I encourage you to visit our site, thealabamatake.com. Click on shop and you'll find the link to buy me a coffee, which is a lot like Patreon, sort of, except it's not a monthly thing. It's just a donation thing where you can make a donation and help keep the site and various podcasts going. You can also visit buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake, if that's all one word. And you can donate any amount you wish. Before I introduce our fellow miscreants, I want to take some time to thank Mr. 87 Jedi. I actually know his name now, by the way, and he's a very kind listener to the podcast, but he also bought us all a coffee, quotation marks around that, so to speak. He made a donation to the site, and we just want to thank him with sincerity. It's really cool of him, and he frequently comments after listening to the show, so it's fun to engage with somebody like that who's as thoughtful and attentive as he's been these last several months. Well, today I've got with me my guys, my pals, my comrades. Co-host Adam Morrow's here.
Me mates.
Well, I was going to announce that you're assistant to the co-host now, Mr. Donovan Reinwald.
He's here.
Where's my cut of that coffee? Well, I see Blaine drinking a coffee. You know what I'm drinking? Water. Where's my coffee?
That's not even bubbly water. What are you doing, man?
It's just, well, it's not as hot as it was. It's 71 degrees here and raining, so I'm switched to normal water.
Talk to me, guys, about COVID. Have you heard the good news, Donovan? You're not in Alabama, but have you heard the good news? About COVID.
About COVID. Yeah, of course. Here I thought the COVID was going to be the Marlins star player this year. And then lo and behold, transfers to the Reds.
I thought he was with the Cards.
What the heck? No. He skipped the Cards. He egged the Cards, like their bus. But that was just a schoolboy prank, if you will. No, he switched to the Reds. Why?
I mean, Jeter really didn't put a tight lid on him. And so away he goes. You can't. If you love it, you got to let it go and hope it'll come back to you. I think that was Jeter's approach down there.
So the numbers across Alabama and in the county I live in as well are down or underreported or both, but it seems as though the mask thing is working.
That was the most getting a little better Lennon-McCartney way of saying those numbers that I've heard so far. The numbers are going down or just not being reported?
Yeah, I mean,
that's what's happening.
I mean, if they're not being reported, hopefully that means that people aren't being sick, or maybe they're asymptomatic. But
they're just high.
They're just erasing the numbers.
No, they're dying at home like real Americans. They're not going to some sort of government hospital, okay? They drag themselves out to the woods like a dog would.
Die with a little dignity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, numbers are here down here as well. That's not a bad thing.
We hope, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't gone to the woods lately, so God knows what's piling up out there. But
so our numbers have been pretty good, and we got a special shout out from Dr. Fauci because we've all been so good at wearing our masks up here in Connecticut.
That guy.
But school is opening like next 2 weeks, so I assume we're about 3 weeks from everything shutting down again.
Oh, I can see students moving into dorms from my house. So I mean, it's just like a matter of time.
Yeah. We're done.
Students return here in class Thursday. They're doing hybrid schedule where a group will go on Monday, Tuesday, and then the last half of the alphabet would go Thursday, Friday, and Wednesday is a cleaning day. So as a teacher, that seems manageable more so than, at least in social distancing terms and in mask wearing terms, that's just a little bit more manageable. I felt comfortable with that. Now, we'll see how it shakes out
my question
in 2 weeks or so.
My question, Blaine, for you is how long before a student sneezes directly into your mouth?
Well, I'm going to be wearing a mask the whole time because I...
Mask protects them, not you.
Christ. Donovan, what are you doing? What are you holding in your hand right now?
Oh, it's a mint.
The crunching you hear.
Are you like putting it directly on the microphone while you take it out of the wrapper? God, what's wrong with you?
Our listenership has been down, and there are reasons for this. No, what's been on your pop culture menus lately? I'm going to open the floor. We're gonna dive into pop culture specifics in a minute, but you guys been watching anything? Listening to anything? Reading anything? For Christ's sake, say something.
Donovan, what do you got?
I feel like this, I just feel like a deer in the headlights whenever Blaine asks this question. Because it's like everything. It's like, do we want to talk about, like, you know, my favorite movie of the year came out, you know, 35 years ago, right? That's the level I'm at.
Well, I know I was actually opening the floor in hopes that you guys would continue that text we've had going, I guess, yesterday, where Adam mentioned that he watched something. It's Morrow movie marathon time here in quarantine.
If we were really going to catch up on that, that would be a quite a list. I'm trying to see what all would be on it. But most recently, yeah, I had never seen, you know, one of the beautiful things about the Coen brothers is their how busy they stay. There's always something going on or something they're connected to. And so there's still a lot that I haven't seen somehow. Like I'll find like some new corner of their universe. And somehow I hadn't seen A Serious Man until last night. It was incredible. I mean, it was so incredible that I just started firing off text messages, had to know who all has seen this film and who hasn't. And now, I mean, I know Donovan, you've seen it. When did you see it close to the original date? Because it's over 10 years old. This is a horrible pop culture podcast material.
It's what they did. No, did they do Burn After Reading and then this after No Country for Old Men? Or am I think they did.
I think it was like 2009, yeah. But this just proves the point of their, just the rate at which they churn stuff out.
Well, have you heard the theory that the Coen brothers do things in pairs?
Yes.
I don't know if it's been confirmed or if they've talked about it ever. Donovan, you might can comment on that, but they tend to do a comedy about a very similar thematic thing and then a drama about a similar thematic thing. And it sort of takes, I guess, a critic's eye or an expert's eye to kind of unravel maybe what the motifs and things are.
Do we have like an example?
No Country for Old Men and Burn After Reading are both dealing with, in many ways, meaninglessness and trying to, right, like interpret out of chaos. Or
how timely.
Did they do Fargo and then The Big Lebowski? I feel like I'm looking at their filmography because I'm an idiot and can't remember when anything came out. Miller's Crossing, Barton Think.
Two that I've yet to see, shame on me. And nor have I seen A Serious Man. I wouldn't even mind having a week off from life and just every night watching two Coen brothers films just to say that I've seen them all. There are some actors and directors that when I think of them, I think, man, I'd like to see everything they've done. And they are at the very top of the list.
They make it pretty easy, too, because it's just enjoyable to inhabit their worlds most of the time. Like, it's not like you can think of a bunch of directors that you love, but I don't want to watch two of their movies every night for days on end. But I could totally do that with the Coen brothers.
So that's it. Our next podcast will be Coen brothers.
I think it should be.
I mean, it could be.
I think Adam needs to track down Barton Fink next because it has William Faulkner in it.
He's in it.
It's very clearly Faulkner, right? It's because he's writing for Hollywood movies in the in the 40s, right? And it's Faulkner.
It's a nod to Faulkner.
It's great.
I love it.
Adam watched A Serious Man, loved it, he claimed.
One of the best films I've seen lately.
Like, would you say the best films you've ever seen, like, ever? Is it that good?
No, I mean, I don't know about that, but it's definitely, when I think back about a year where I've probably watched more movies at home than maybe since, like, college, and it Yeah, it definitely stands out as one of the top ones.
That's one thing I've enjoyed about semi-quarantine that we're in now. We're not quite in quarantine. We're wide open now, to be honest. One of the things I did enjoy this summer, though, was we got into a Saturday night movie habit here for a couple of weeks. And it transitioned into the podcast. You know, we did Palm Springs and then Veil of Night movie. Both really good and very, very different. And we enjoyed talking about them. So that was been... I need to continue that, maybe. That's a good idea.
Be good. It'd be good. Now, the other, I do have another pop culture thing. You know, every now and again, we enjoy really just ripping on something. And boy, do I have something. The CBS All Access app. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, but I've refused to ever even click or look at it.
Same here.
As good SEC football fans, we have just found workarounds to that, right? For years at this point?
Absolutely.
So they somehow acquired the rights to the Champions League after ESPN lost it and then Fox lost it. So the biggest club soccer matches in the world somehow are on CBS, and I hate it. And Vern is not involved, which makes it even worse. But, I download this thing to watch some of these games, and there's like a free month trial, and I'm thinking, yeah, this will get me through this kind of the meat of this tournament, and then I'll decide if I like it or not, and then re-up. Guys, this is the worst app I have ever used on like a TV interface. Just awful. And one of the things, the true tragic thing about it is they have the rights to all of the Challenge. So during this time, I have been trying to watch old Challenge episodes, but the interface is so poor. I mean, they pretty much have everything to keep me hooked for at least another month subscription. It's awful. You guys haven't
okay, break this down. What makes it awful? Like, paint me a picture.
Okay, so you know, we have come to expect a certain level of functionality from our Netflixes and our Primes and our Hulus, and even Hulu has kind of been behind user friendliness to me.
Users behind the curve. Hulu's behind the curve. Yeah,
a little,
just a touch. And they recently made improvements that make it more like a Netflix or a Prime. That I thought, oh, that makes that makes a world of difference. This CBS All Access is the glitchiest, just messes up all the time. It's all you have to like to watch an episode of the Challenge. You're making like minimum of 5 or 6 clicks, which is absurd. Sometimes it doesn't work. And so the only way to make it work is to go all the way back to the home screen and then advance through it again. When an episode ends, oftentimes it'll just like jump back to the last where the commercial break would have been and start playing the episode again. It's awful.
That is very frustrating.
Awful. Now, on the other hand, we are about to wrap up the our second Challenge season since downloading the app, I don't know, like a week ago. So not all bad, but revisiting some old heroes for sure.
Now, they don't have all seasons, right? They have like season 11 through the current, right?
Yeah, something but I mean, like that's like 11 through 30 something. So there's
a lot of
material there.
Speaking of apps that glitch, I'll throw in my 2 cents here. We have been watching Defending Jacob on Apple TV Plus. And up until watching this show, Defending Jacob, which is not a bad show, by the way. It's, you know, I'll give it a hesitant thumbs up. We're not finished with the show. Mystery kind of show. But anyway, Apple TV Plus, I swear we will get 5 minutes into the show and the sound will drag and then it will... the picture itself will freeze for like a few seconds, and then whether or not it'll pick back up, it's a matter of I guess fate or whatever. But I think that in a good thing to say about Apple, I think that I figured it out recently. I think they're streaming at such a high quality that I had to go into my Roku and change how great I wanted my streaming to come at me. So I had to kind of knock it down a notch, and it kind of fixed that problem. So
that makes
it
sense.
It wasn't all bad. So Apple's actually just trying to do their best, it sounded like, and it was messing with my how fast it was coming at me or how strong it was coming at me. Maybe that seems to be the case. I Googled it over and over, and that was the only logical explanation. But Defending Jacob, there's an answer to my pop culture diet. And also, I'll throw a real quick shout out to Hulu. There's a show on there called In My Skin, BBC show on Hulu, 5 episodes long, 30 minutes each, is a serious look at a specific teen issue that you don't see a lot. So I'll give that a quick shout out. It might even be worth talking about here on the podcast one day if you guys get around to that one.
Well, what's the issue?
I'd rather not say, because I didn't know going in.
Okay.
I did not know.
I was like, I got it.
I just knew it was a coming of age kind of thing from BBC, and I thought, well, we've seen that 1,000 times. It's some of the people who had a hand in it had a hand in The End of the Fucking World on Netflix.
Mm.
So, but it does not have that kind of vibe to it. It does not have that same tone. It's a very different tone. But and if you guys are interested, it's 30 minutes and, you know, 5 episodes. I thought that's pretty good. I do have a question for maybe Donovan or Adam. Have you guys seen Umbrella Academy on Netflix?
I read the comics.
I have not.
Yeah, I've had at least 2 people recommend this show to me. One lady I work with has been recommending it of late, and I'm trying to figure out why. Is it good? What's the backstory there, Donovan?
Yeah, what you got, Donovan?
Oh, well, so it begins with, it's fine. It's the guy that writes it is the My Chemical Romance guy, Gerard Way.
Oh, tell me more.
But the artist who does it is Gabriel Moon and Fabio Bot. So there's a pair of brothers. They're Brazilian, and they wrote a book together. They're really, really great artists. And it's they have different last names, so I always get them mixed up. Gabriel Ba is the artist, and they did one of the completely like great comics of. Or graphic novels of 2010 to 2020 called Day Tripper. It's totally recommended. It's sort of gentle, magical realist comic. But anyway, so the art is super good. And the idea, I think, with Umbrella Academy is it's sort of X-Men-esque, where or Royal Tenenbaums-esque, where you have this family of like children that all are unusual in some way, and they were adopted and turned into a super team by their foster father, and one of them disappeared, and they've all sort of broken up, and they're a little bit of a fractured, dysfunctional family. And then the one that disappeared came back because he's been time traveling, and you know, so he says you have to do this up. The first one's all right. The second one deals with the Kennedy assassination, so that was fun. And God shows up. And then the third one came out this last year, I think. So it's been not as hugely prolific series, but it's worth picking up. It's a little, I feel like you have to be a little versed in superhero tropes to really enjoy it, but we've all watched 20 years of Marvel movies or whatever it is now. So we probably all get it. I don't know anything about the show.
Well, I was going to ask, is there a particular reason why you've avoided the show or just lack of time or something?
No, you know, I haven't watched a lot of TV yet and there's lately, and there's just been other things I'd rather watch higher on my list.
Like a 35-year-old movie?
Absolutely. I watched His Girl Friday last night. That Clark Gable, boy, Cary Grant. That Cary Grant, he sure makes me laugh. You know, he just makes me laugh.
Donovan coming in with the topical information. So, Adam, I know that you and I have been talking about I May Destroy You some. I just want to check in and with that one. It's starting to wind down. I think it's got like 2 episodes left. This show continues to keep me on my toes. You never know what kind of show you're going to get almost week to week, sort of. And you definitely don't know what the characters are going to do or what little bit of information is going to be revealed. And not in these major earth-shattering ways, but
it manages to build, you know, there's not like one big revelation, but I feel like this is one of those shows where it's a little bit at a time to where just the ground is just barely shifting, you know what I mean? And so the landscape is totally unrecognizable, like one little chip at a time. I don't know. I've been continue to be very impressed. I'll be honest. I've let the last couple episodes pile up and I need to dive in. Does it kind of continue that vibe?
My opinion of it is that it is still a great show, but I think it might be spreading thin. And I can't tell if that's on me or the show. It's tackling so many issues at once, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's quite admirable because it's doing it quite well. But it's also been given 12 episodes, I think, to do it. And for me, maybe my brain has gotten a little used to the 10-episode or 8-episode run of these 30-minute shows, or like the BBC show I talked about earlier, 5 episodes. I mean, that's ridiculously short, but I think it might be stretched a little too much for me personally, though it's still pretty good.
It is insane to the days of HBO doing a 12-episode run. That is kind of tough to wrap your mind around. I mean, thinking about when this show started, I'm looking now, the first episode aired on June 7th. And I mean, it's coming out in a particularly momentous summer in the world, in America especially. So like thinking about kind of the ways that it's interacting with that, almost, you know, not certainly not by design necessarily specifically. I mean, it's, if it wasn't good at addressing a lot of these issues, it wouldn't be having those conversations with culture at large, but it is interesting timing. But yeah, I mean, just it feels like this started like in another, I don't know, that's what, 12 episodes. That is a long time to try to keep something going, but it has let the world build to do all of those subtle little movements. So I mean, I'll be interested to see how it lands the plane, so to speak.
Oh yeah. Me too. Michaela Cole, who wrote and stars in the show, she's taken shots at a lot of things. And one of the more recent things was social media. And she did it in a way that was almost made her character, pushed her character to a boundary of unlockable that I don't know.
I mean, she kind of flirted with that up until that point, even, you know, like you, the difference in, you definitely feel sympathy and then respect and empathy for, and, you know, all of these things that make it a very rich story that, you know, we've talked on here before, again, because it's been 12 weeks, it feels like forever ago, that it started as kind of a whodunit almost, and then has morphed into this whole other tale. And like she's really good at twisting who you like and who you're rooting for, and even making you question what the purpose of doing those things with characters in a story is. And if the world is rich enough, do you have to have that as a device? I don't know. I've been impressed. So you lose a little bit of, I don't know, you're not rooting for her as much.
I wouldn't put it quite that way. I would just say that she becomes less likable a little, and it's going to take these last two episodes are going to require a bit of a redemption, maybe on a small scale.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how, you know, there's a lot of people who make, again, I guess because of the length, they're able to make poor decisions and how they treat others and then go through redemption cycles. I don't know. Again, it'll just be interesting to see if they're, and surely it's not going to close off in like a neat way, you know, because it's such a sprawling show. But it'll be interesting to see.
It's funny that the way that we talk about this show, you would think it's some sort of CIA detective show. We're using these words like sprawling, and that the plot is juggling a bunch of things. But it's a very confined show. It's very confined to her friends, and her experience.
It is, but it doesn't. I think maybe the clever part of it is confining it just to a group of friends. And, you know, I mean, the first episode taking on an issue like rape, like sexual assault, it draws these pretty hard lines around our expectations for a story like that. And then to just slowly subvert those by letting these characters feel the full spectrum of life, you know, have to deal with, she's dealing with assault, but at the same time, like trying to finish a book and trying to still have a social life and all these kind of things. And it just lets, it just breathes so much. And I think of other shows that maybe try to do the tracking with young people kind of thing. If girls is your archetype of that, this just feels so much more genuine and effortless, I guess, in the way that it confronts really heavy topics, but also does it with a light enough hand to make you laugh the whole time.
Yeah, I agree. That's a pretty good summation of it. So to shift gears, I wanted to propose a question, and I'll tell you the impetus of this. I was sitting around listening to some records one night, and I was thinking about album covers and album art, really, because I was holding and listening to Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. And the music on the record and its themes are rather bleak, and that opening track is about a killing spree. You know, if you don't know, that cover features a look outside of a car window and like this flat land. It seems to be a harsh winter. It's in black and white. And even the font and the labeling of the cover, it's just very stark. It's just has Springsteen's name at the top and Nebraska at the bottom. It's a similar thing going on with the song titles when you flip it over and look at the back. No flair. And so all of that buildup is to ask, what other cover and art, and here's the question, it's a specific one, what other cover and art best exemplifies the music within? Not necessarily what's the greatest cover album art, because you could go in any direction with that, but what do you think, if you picked up the record and didn't know a thing about it, you got something from the cover? You got a hint.
I love this question. Because it's not what's the best. Like, I think if you looked at, like, Nevermind's cover, I would never know what Nirvana sounds like from that. I might have,
exactly.
You know. I love this question. And I think Nebraska is maybe the best one.
It's got to be close, right? I could only think of one other good example, but you guys take it from here and tell me what other cover art gives you a hint of what's to come.
I have a couple. So one I came up, a couple I came up. One is, I texted my friend Joel with this question, and he had a suggestion. So I'll lead with his. His suggestion is for Yola Tango's "And Then Nothing Turned Itself Inside Out."
Perfect answer. Absolutely perfect answer. I mean, that is it. That looks like that record sounds.
Mm-hmm.
It just had a 20th or 20. What would it have been?
I think that was 20th. Yeah.
It came out in 90. Like that. Anyway, there was some anniversary and there was a big, I think Stereo Gum did a big article on it. And they even, a big part of it was talking about the cover and how much that inhabits the. Like, it seems like the record was made inside that cover.
Yeah.
Like, the studio is somehow in there. Man, that's a great answer.
Yeah.
So describe the cover to anyone who doesn't know, and then link that to the music. What about the cover?
Oh, do we have listeners without Google?
Well, no. But,
maybe they're driving, Donovan. Maybe they're being safe.
Listeners without Google?
What do you mean I look at my phone while I drive all the time. I'm driving right now.
The cover is
it's a
suburban house,
yeah,
right?
And I think it's by this could also be the cover for The Dead of Night, I think, or not The Dead of Night, The Vast of Night. I meant the movie we talked about a little while ago.
Absolutely,
because you've got kind of a suburban. What would you say? Are these ranch style homes? I never can remember what that is. You know,
I think yeah.
And you've got a guy at the end of a driveway in his road. And there's just like light coming down from above. Maybe it's a street light. Maybe it's something else. Kind of foggy, kind of misty. And Adam can probably do a better of relating this to the album, the sound of the album. But to me, it's like the picture is a little pulled out. And like is it fair to call the music on that album distant and alienating, yet also transcendental? Like transcendent?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of the ultimate.
It's such a good
album. I feel like a lot of people would point to that as like their best version of themselves, even though they kind of pivot perpetually.
Yeah.
But I mean, that cover just has everything. I mean, the light that you're talking about that could be UFO, could be streetlight, whatever, is not at the center of the frame. That's not like the main focus. I mean, if you want to go by the rule of thirds with photography, I guess your eye is drawn there. But, mm-hmm. you know, there's also just a big portion of it that mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. unsung hero of this, to me, are the power lines. Mm-hmm.
Overhead. Oh, yeah, totally.
Just implying like electricity in the night air kind of humming away up there quietly above this.
It's such a
unsuspecting street.
It's such a,
I don't know,
cool album cover. It's great.
And the evergreens behind the house.
Yeah.
A little Twin Peaksy kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gives it a sense of place.
Yeah, that kind of like unsettling, you know, like if David Lynch takes Happy Days and makes it you know, just unfamiliar enough to terrify you. It is that kind of thing.
I mean, even the way the album opens with Every Day is like perfectly encapsulated there. You know, I mean, it's immediately the mood is set and it agrees perfectly with the record. And even it's, you know, it's got sweet songs. It's got kind of like more upbeat songs, but it always stays kind of in that chill space. I love it. That's a great answer.
Yeah. Thanks to Joel Atkinson for that one.
Thanks, Joel.
Now, what's
Adam,
yours?
What you got, man?
Well, Donovan has his own personal answer.
Yeah, I've got a couple written. I've got an honorable mention, too. But the first one that jumped into my head was, we're not talking about, you know, if we're talking about this feel, looking at this feels like listening to this record, this mm-hmm. might be one that I can't justify very well, but Sufjan Stevens' Seven Swans, because it's like, if you look at that, you know, it's a swan. It's sort of flying, but it's also like almost, it's a drawing, but it's almost really, you've got kind of these like gnarled feet, right? It's got the claws when the, you know, it's got, what do you call them, flippers, right? Because it's a water animal. And it just feels like something about that, like it's like familiar, but it's weird. And it seems like it means something, but you're not quite sure what, like, it feels like there is, it feels like I'm not just looking at a swan, right? Like, it feels like there's deeper meaning here. Like, it just the strangeness that I think you encounter in that album and just how idiosyncratically personal some of that album is. I think it's just perfectly captured by this, like, mundane and yet not mundane image.
That's a good one.
That's an interesting answer. I would never have come up with that one.
I'm going to stick with the, you said Bruce, and it made me think classic rock, and one that I've always, I mean, I go and look at this. I did this inside the last week, looked at it and tried to understand what is so appealing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Neil Young's On the Beach.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's a great, I mean, it's, there's like these weird, there's an umbrella, right? And a table. I don't even have it pulled up right now. This is me trying to do it from memory. In one side of the frame, and then the other one is the car fender sticking out, right? Like it's buried in the sand. And he's kind of standing there looking out at the Pacific. And I mean, if you look at that and Walk On comes on, it's just like, yeah, this makes perfect sense. Edit the whole record on a beach, cloudy day, sun starting to go down. That's it. He captured it.
I love how it's I like that it's weird, and they've got this umbrella that looks like, right, the beach umbrella looks like it's made out of like a 70s couch. There's a hanger hanging up inside it.
Right, it's the whole thing is very 70s, and the interior of the umbrella kind of matches the chairs, right?
Yeah, it's great.
And that yellow, he's also wearing it like a yellow jacket off in the distance that kind of matches the same tone. It's fantastic.
Donovan, you thought of a good example of the opposite end of the spectrum, where the art was so bad that it might even turn you off.
So it didn't turn me off. It's so bad that it makes me laugh every time, just because it's so, it's just one of those like, what are you doing? And this is from an artist I actually enjoy. I like Kate, it's Kate Bush. I actually really like Kate Bush. But everyone, please Google her album 50 Words for Snow, because it appears to be like a snow sculpture of someone French kissing a snowman, like a snowman. It's inexplicable.
Oh, this looks great. Right. You don't like this? This is wonderful.
No, this is so goofy. It's so goofy.
No,
I think
that's your loss, Kimasabi.
I think someone just, I have three, I think, iconic honorable mentions that popped into my head too, but these are more.
All right.
So I think the cover art for Station to Station, which is pulled from The Man Who Fell to Earth, is, you know, David Bowie was a coked out alien when he was making that movie. So if you look at that cover and then you get, you know, TVC15 or the you know, Station to Station, it's like, yep, he's completely, this is going to be weird, sort of future sounding pop. I'll say Joy Division's Unknown Pleasures album, I think, is iconic for a reason. And then I think a real good honorable mention is Murmur, the first R.E.M. album.
You stole my honorable mention. I mean, that we would be remiss as a Southern-based podcast to not mention possibly the greatest Southern cover of all time.
I've got three, I think, that are worth bringing up, if not talking about. One is Wilco's Yankee Hotel Foxtrot.
Phenomenal.
Does that cover replicate the sound inside? I'm not sure. Or if it's just a good cover.
I thought about that one, too. And I came down on it's a good cover. And it's so iconic that looking at it makes me think of the music. But
That's chicken and egg for me. I don't know which.
I know. Yeah. I ultimately decided that it did not. So others can reasonably feel otherwise, I should say.
My second was Damian Girardo's Where Shall You Take Me? If you're familiar with that album, it too has a very Nebraska thing going on where there's some bleak imagery in the songs and themes within the songs themselves. And that album cover is like a 1930s photograph, if you found one in your grandparents' drawer. It almost looks like that kind of thing of a Midwestern landscape with a house. And I'm doing this from memory too. So it's got that feel, and the songs have a similar frequency, I think.
That works for me. That makes sense.
Yeah. And my third one, It wasn't Nick Drake's Pink Moon.
Although that's a very good one.
Maybe I was thinking of Nick Drake's Pink Moon, though I don't know if the image matches quite what you're getting in that album. It's just a good album cover. I'll leave it to listeners. So listeners, if you have ideas on the album aren't matching the songs, give us a shout.
Can I ask, are there any that are so aggressively bad that you want to bring up? Because I feel like there's some artists that just never quite got it right. Like when you flip through their discography and you think about how great their songs might be, how bad...
I'm so often turned off by band names and band art that sometimes it takes years for me to get through. I also remember another honorable mention. I'll just squeeze it in real quick. The Dexateens' Red Dust Rising.
That's a good one.
That album art really comes close to The Sound with the End, maybe. So I'll throw that one out there. But ones that just got it so wrong that maybe they lost listeners, I don't know.
Every Weezer album, I think.
Every one.
Every single one. There's not a good one there.
Even the Blue album.
Not a good one.
Pinkerton's a pretty good terrible album cover.
As albums or as covers?
You know, it's not just Weezer. It's the kind of people who listen to Weezer, I guess, that I have the problem with. You know what? I think I might have a separate issue here.
I feel like you're going after a particular listener.
Well, I got news for you. He ain't listening.
He suggested this segment.
Did he?
On Twitter. He tweeted on blame.
Well, here's my controversial suggestion that I was scrolling through trying to find, with classic rock in mind, some good examples. I think that the majority of Tom Petty album covers completely missed the mark.
Yeah.
I think there's an alternate reality where his album covers match the sound and they kick ass. I think they are kind of bad.
Well, he just goes with the band shot or picture of himself on it. That's what he's done through the years, and except for maybe Wildflowers and Saving Grace.
Wildflowers is his best album cover.
Not Saving Grace, Highway Companion. So Highway Companion is an actual piece of art trying to, it's like an album art instead of just a picture of the band or a picture of him. So that one, it seems as if he was trying, or whoever, you know, was in charge of album art. I always wonder who's in charge, because with Bob Dylan, his is just pictures of himself too. His missed the mark. It's just a picture of him doing whatever.
But he has some iconic ones at least.
No, they're pretty, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Blonde on Blonde's huge as far as being iconic, but it's just a picture of him, a blurry picture of him. But, yeah, you're right. Tom Petty, if you only had to go by what was on the cover, you may or may not listen.
I'm just thinking about richness of song, especially like in its ability. Because like with Bob Dylan, we're getting into some tricky territory here. Mm-hmm. With Petty, I feel like the whole band, when they're cooking, creates this like very... soundscapey kind of thing. Not that Dylan doesn't, but Petty maybe relies on it a bit more at times, and I feel like that translates so well into great art that never was. That's enough That's enough dudes sitting around talking about Tom Petty and Bob Dylan.
Hey, no. Is there ever enough dudes sitting around talking about Tom Petty?
Oh, I think we've hit our quota.
This is such a good question. I'm trying to think about it. I definitely think I don't like any of the Who's album covers. I don't know. I think that'll be one of my...
But do you like the Who?
Not really.
No.
So that doesn't quite... But that doesn't quite work. This is such a good question. Like, which one is, like, they're so good, but their albums are so bad?
I'm going to go out on a limb and say any Pat Boone album.
Well, they're all just not working. Awful.
It's just not clicking for me. So yeah, we'll turn it over to our listeners. And if you ever want a good laugh, you can Google horrible album art and just scroll through the images there. And,
I think we all just did.
Yes. And they are so funny. There's one called Ken by Request Only. That's a good one. Google that one, and I'll give you another one. Katui, Catui, and obviously, yeah, Google that. It's a blue album guy. I can't believe that made it past whoever was putting the album together. Anyway, a lot of them are foreign, obviously. So enjoy that, people. We're gonna go into break, okay? We're gonna take a break, and on the other side, we'll do a wrap up on our thoughts on Perry Mason. Thanks, people, for listening to our podcast. If you've made it this far, God help you. Don't forget our programming note that if you're a regular listener and you listen kind of on a week-to-week basis, there will be no podcast next week from us. No official podcast on August 25th, but we'll be back on September 1st. And I know for a fact we'll be covering Lovecraft Country from HBO. It's a new show coming at you from producer Jordan Peele. We don't have advertising here, but we'll quickly plug that you can help support us by going to buymeacoffee.com/thealabamatake or just visit the site and click on shop, and that'll get you to the same place that you can do any sort of donation that you wish. It's kind of like a Patreon, and you're welcome to talk to us. If you have ideas on those album covers that we missed or we overlooked, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can comment on the site itself if you so desire. We appreciate all of you who read and listen. Click on your podcast app and leave us a review if you have the desire to do so. We're going to come back on the other side and talk about Perry Mason. Okay, guys, so we're back, and we're going to talk about that finale of Perry Mason. If you haven't gotten that far with the show, if you're catching up, we'll spoil it, so you might want to tune out until you are caught up with it. I want to get around to what you guys thought, but one of my favorite critics, television critics, Alan Sepinwall, I love to read his stuff, though I don't always agree with him, wrote that he felt like the finale was a bit hit or miss because it robbed Perry Mason of this signature move of getting the actual criminal to confess on the stand. He talked about that in his review, though he talked about other things that kind of were wrong. Instead, the show only gave us a moment where Matthew Reese as Perry Mason was practicing putting the villainous Detective Innes on the stand and getting him to confess, but we don't actually get that moment. He sort of dreams it up or practices it in his home, but that doesn't happen in real life. And Sepinwall argues that you should have something like that, or even more spectacular than this amazing aha moment, I guess, the signature move in place. What do you guys think? Did the finale work for you? Did it tie up the loose ends that you wanted? Did it leave things ambiguous where you wanted that to be ambiguous? What did you think of the final?
It was a little anticlimactic. I think what it mostly felt like for me was the big dramatic culmination was kind of the penultimate episode was kind of, and this was a lot more of like denouement, and we're setting you up for season two. Like, Perry Mason will return.
Yeah, it seemed like kind of we've got the whole band together. We barely kind of by the skin of our teeth won, and they even kind of wink at the fact that they legitimately won when the votes are counted and the bribes are handed out. I agree. I thought that it's kind of like the TV thing now for the penultimate episode to have the majority of the drama and kind of leave the last episode to wrap things up. It seemed to follow that pretty well. I don't know about the idea of his signature move being getting him to confess on the stand. I didn't really miss that. I thought Innes getting murdered in a fountain was pretty sweet because he was, I really didn't like that guy. The actor did a great job.
He was asking for it.
He was asking for it, and that was
that was good.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed that. So, I don't think that maybe some more could have been left. You know, not unsolved, but unaddressed. Perhaps I thought that we kind of talked last time we spoke about where they take Sister Alice from here, if Tatiana Maslany will be involved in season two. They gave her kind of the tidy conclusion that I would have hoped for. I thought they did a good job with her. That was kind of my biggest question, because I thought she was so good, was what they were going to do with her.
And it does seem like they're narratively done with her, right?
Yeah, it seems that way, but she got a satisfying send-off, I guess.
Yeah, they had
a little...
I was going to say good moment.
A little ambiguous.
There. Yeah.
And it almost, you know, that we talked about the tension that maybe just the actors had and it wasn't the characters necessarily. I don't know. You never know where that line is, but that carried on into the last scene. I almost thought they were, you know, going to ride off into the sunset together or something.
Could have happened. You know, and this is something that Steppenwolf was griping about or had qualms with about the show, is that the whole first season was the pilot, and which is another thing that television is doing these days, especially like the Netflix shows that you binge, where all 10 episodes are the setup for the second season. This show was, I think, originally, I mentioned it on the podcast, it was originally a limited series or touted as one.
Yeah, it was billed as one.
But that final episode, especially the final 10 minutes, was a definite recognition that we're going to do another season or two or three or four.
Yeah, absolutely. This seems to be set up for, if not the long haul, definitely a few more cases. And it'll be interesting to see if it will still center on one case at a time or if they're going to be juggling multiple problems, you know, what the future holds.
Yeah, especially because you won't have the private eye bit sort of propping up the first two or three episodes. You know, it'll all be the lawyering.
Yeah, it will be. The private eye stuff will be handled by Chris Chalk, who plays Paul Drake, and Shay Wiggum, who plays Pete, the guy, the investigator who kind of quit Perry Mason, but it looks like he's going to be working for Hamilton Berger, who is probably set up to be Perry Mason's kind of rival, it seems. And that was how the original show,
antagonist,
I think, worked.
Yeah.
So do you guys, how do you feel about an entire series, or excuse me, an entire season being like the pilot, like the setup stuff?
I mean, if you can make, you know, if you can make it interesting, do whatever you want. It's a good and it's an interesting point, especially if we're... I don't know, you know, I don't know now what, let's say this has six seasons. Am I going to care about season one if seasons two through six are the real meat of it? I don't know. But I enjoyed this season. It was good. It was fun.
It left me optimistic. I had a few friends text and say, how can they ever, people who are maybe bigger fans of it than I am at this point, say, like, how can they top season one because they enjoyed it so much? And I enjoyed it too, but to me it got better as the season went on, which made me look forward to the next one even more. And I could totally see how somebody enjoyed Perry Mason PI, you know, and the tension with him and EB and them trying to work all that. That was fun in its own regard, but it seemed to me like it really got in gear towards the latter half.
Agree.
I think that shows that do a full season as a pilot is a case-by-case basis. I've seen some that are just like, oh, I felt like I wasted my time. They could have gotten into it. But I don't feel like this one did because it was probably so well done, I think. And I feel like some of that backstory on Perry Mason being haunted by the war, haunted by a divorce, haunted by his family's farm, I think that could work to help flesh out the character in later seasons.
Agreed. And even the... You know, we've talked a lot about how just good everyone is on this cast, and the backstory with Della will be great. You know, you can really just run down the whole list of characters and the people who really started at point A and ended at point B. All of their journeys were pretty satisfying.
I'm especially hopeful that this is going to make getting as much as we did with Drake's origin. I hope that we're in for really interesting stuff with him in the future.
Yeah, that seems like that'll be some rich story territory.
And I like that guy. I like Chris Chalk, right? That's his name.
It gives the show.
Oh, I was just going to say, they felt all of the actors being together and playing off of each other really felt like they picked up steam, especially in the second half. And that made me more excited for season two. And now I'm like, Chalk and Reese play off of each other really well. And
it gives the show an opportunity to really focus on some issue, like race issues, gay issues with Juliet Rylance's performance as Della, and some things that maybe we don't see from shows set in 1930s and 1940s. So it could be a very exciting show. I'm of the opinion that this show has an opportunity to be one of two things. It's either going to be one, a show that's really stellar with a lot of things to say and one of HBO's big standard dramas for years to come, or it's going to be two, just a pretty good hang for Sunday, you know, just a decent show enough, you know, to watch on Sunday evening. So, but I just don't see it getting unwatchable. So if you haven't checked out Perry Mason and you made it this far, then I suggest you do, because it could develop into something good.
It is currently at the level of a pretty good hang. And that's not, that sounds like damning with faint praise, but actually that's pretty good. Most things aren't a good hang. So if you even make it there, you're doing good.
Yeah.
So, I feel like they had so much to build and get in motion. I mean, I know we're all basically just saying some version of this has a high ceiling.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's primed to try to hit it. But it's like getting a train moving. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't just come out of the gates. And now they have this big thing that's kind of starting to churn. And I agree. I think it can only get better to
me. Are you telling me a dead baby in the opening scene isn't getting the train rolling?
I mean, they threw as much coal on there as they could, but, you know, it's still got it was a big fire, but they weren't going that fast.
All right, guys, you got to give one award to someone who's not Matthew Rhys. Who gets it from this show?
Oh, I really think it's going to have to be, I'm hoping next season is Chris Chalk's, but I just blanked on her name. Della Street, the actor who plays her. Thank
Juliet
you.
Rylance.
She gets my award. She, as much as Matthew Rhys was threaded through this show, through this season, and helped hold it together, really. And they play off of each other incredibly well.
Yeah, I think all of her lines, kind of where she's chipping away at some of the sexism inherent in their workplace, and even his assumptions. They do that in a clever way where, you know, it feels he's not trying to be a dick, but he is being one, and she kind of like knocks him down a little bit. I don't know. That all feels very, if they're able to tackle issues, like kind of like what you're talking about, Blaine, if they're able to tackle issues moving forward like that, that'll be really interesting to see play out, because it felt, the writing was very natural, as was the acting.
So who gets the award from you, Adam? If you had to pick someone, it's not Matthew Rhys, and we can't mention Juliet Rylance.
So glad that I got in there.
I think Mrs. Maslany is the winner for me. I think maybe the back half of the season wasn't as compelling, just because of where the writers pushed her. That's not her fault. I thought her last scene was great, and she was good throughout. And without her kind of grounding the whole church thing, it would have lost me a lot faster. I think kind of her like one foot in the tent and one foot outside way of playing scenes really made it work.
Yeah, good answer. I'm gonna go Stephen Root.
Oh, he was every second he was
or
on,
Stephen Root's mustache.
He was great.
Emily Dodson, the actress who played Emily Dodson, Gail Rankin, who's also on Glow. She did a pretty good job too. She had a tough role, I think, to play. That required some balance that you did not want to see her found guilty, but at the same time, she was a little weird, a little off kilter.
Yeah, kind of trying as hard as they can to make the mother of a dead baby unsympathetic, even though she's not a criminal. And, you know, it pushed her in a weird direction. Now they're wheeling around Southern California taking people's money. So,
yeah, we don't know if their story's over yet or not. They could easily bring both her and Sister Alice back into season two, three, four, whatever they want to do.
I thought the scene where she was kind of making her decision, you could kind of see her making her decision after getting reeled back in with a card with a baby footprint on it, you know. I thought she did really good work there. She was great to watch, where she asked to hold the baby and
Really doing something without having to
speak.
She
was very good.
Yeah. Well, there we go. So that's a wrap on this week's episode. What we're doing, we're taking a week off next week, but we're going to come back September 1st with a couple of episodes of Lovecraft Country under our belts and some more. So we'll let you know online what we'll be covering. And until then, we'll talk to you later.